Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So it's my pleasure today to be joined on the podcast by Professor Pali Hunjin. He is a GP in the northeast of England, as well as being a professor. He is a member of the Access Review Committee at Genomics England and leads our general practice sort of interface. Pali received an OBE in 2000 for services to research and is an emeritus professor at Newcastle University, as well as various other activities. Pali, welcome onto the pod.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. So when you were the president of the British Medical Association, which you were a few years ago, you started the Changing Face of Medicine project, and you have various other activities that you lead. I noticed from your profile on LinkedIn that you have 20 letters after your name. Pretty impressive, and I'm sure they've missed off a few. Not everyone starts life with 20 letters after their name. Sort of, how did you get into medicine, and how did you get involved with things like the BMA and these kind of national scale projects?
Letters don't say much about a person, I must admit. I was born and brought up in Kenya, and I arrived in England at the age of 18 to study medicine at Newcastle University. And I've lived and worked in the Northeast ever since then. I trained initially to go into general practice and had a concurrent job in gastroenterology at our local hospital. So this gave me a flavour of the interface between primary and secondary care. And I was interested in research, so over a period of time, I became involved in colleagues in research of various sorts. And eventually, I found myself taking on the role of the founding dean of medicine at Durham University. This provided a powerful academic environment, and my interest in professionalism started there. And the role between professional values, the importance of scientific advance, but most importantly, the very close and important association between clinicians, the public, and patients, the very heart of the transaction between clinicians and the wider world. So that's where my background is. And as you know, these things just tend to roll along, and that is how I found myself with the BMA as their president about 3 years ago.
That's brilliant. And so tell us a little bit about the British Medical Association. What's its scope, and what does it mean to be the president there?
The BMA is an organization of doctors. And their basic motto over the years has been looking after doctors so they can look after patients. An organization very much concerned with maintaining standards and quality, but of course also with a trade union function, which most people are aware of. The presidential role is essentially a supernumerary one. The council asks someone to be the president. You're not formally elected, neither do you make an application. So it is a bit of an accolade, but it also gives the president the chance to do something that they're keen on and to publicize an area which they are enthusiastic about. And that's why I took the opportunity of asking ourselves, well, look, the world is changing, medicine is changing. How do we project ourselves into the future? What lies ahead? What matters? How might we adapt ourselves for the next, say, 20 years?
I love the image of taking doctors taking care of themselves so they can take care of patients. I'm kind of reminded of the thing when you get on a plane with, always put your own gas mask on first before helping others. What kind of activities does the BMA do to look after doctors? So I imagine at a time like this must be under more pressure than perhaps, in living memory.
Yes, of course. I think at the present time, we're very conscious of the huge amount of pressure that clinicians are under If anything else, the COVID crisis has highlighted the conditions under which doctors, nurses and others in the health service have to work. These pressures can be enormous and intense. It's always been known that clinicians have long hours, but when you have a combination of long hours and very difficult work with difficult conditions to have to work in, such as with PPE, and with patients with a very high level of morbidity and mortality, all these pressures combine to strike at the very heart of what might call one's humanness. It's not so much humanity here, because humanity is, of course, that essence which causes us towards helping our fellow individuals, our fellow men. But the humanness is the bit that comes out in terms of being weak, with all those phrases like the requirement for resilience and patience and so on.
Absolutely. Indeed, I guess we'll get into a discussion, I suspect, of technology and how technology can assist the medical profession and the improvements in care. But often in these conversations we get into, if this works well, it allows the doctors to be more human, because actually you take some of the, you lift the burden on some of the pieces that are less to do with that common humanity. I guess before we dive into that, when you were the president of the BMA in 2016-17, you created a project at the time, The Changing Face of Medicine, which endures beyond your presidency. Maybe tell us a bit about the scope of that. Then we can maybe pick up on some of the work that it's doing and the issues that raises.
Sure. I think that professionalism has been at the heart of medicine always, you know, ever since I think doctors came into being. And the kind of things we wanted to think more deeply about were the items and themes which mattered in this coming day and age and which were under stress. And I'd just like to mention some of them. The doctor-patient relationship, for example, that link which has evolved so much with the arrival of the newer technologies, the openness of the internet, or what has been described as the democratization of knowledge. This has redefined the relationship between clinicians and the public at large. Also then, whether we have enough doctors, is the workforce and the environment in which it functions appropriate for the time that we're in? What impact will technological advancements have on not just on clinicians, but also on the public? And interestingly, you might say, well, that will reduce a certain type of workload, but that was not necessarily what was thought by the groups who met to discuss these areas. And of course, clinician well-being and morale was a very big and important area for us. I think people do not realize the level to which this has become an important issue within the profession. And finally, at that stage, we thought we really did need to look at both medical education and training and medical leadership. And there were some serious questions to be asked. Are doctors being trained in a way which makes them fit for the future? Are we sticking with a model that goes back 100, maybe 50 years, but one which is no longer fit for purpose for, you know, perhaps the year 2050? And most people qualifying now will still be practicing in 30 years' time. And finally, and I'm embarrassed to say this, there was a strong feeling that perhaps we didn't have systems for fostering the kind of medical leadership that a major profession deserves and requires. Of course, we have good managers and leaders in, say, fields like diabetes or, you know, surgical organization, but leadership in the sense of leaders being visionaries, that this was an area which we were lacking in. Having identified these areas, we moved the work on through the Academy of the Medical Royal Colleges into the second part of our project, which was really more to do with how we might start to improve things for the future and to prepare our profession.
Wow, so that's a very wide-ranging set of themes, right? Well-being, technology, how doctors and patients interact, education, leadership. Paint a picture for us, if you can, of what you would like the world to look like in 2050. Let's imagine that person who's qualifying now and who is still going to be practicing in 2050. The program around the Changing Face of Medicine is ultimately, I guess, targeting policy changes. What would that world look like?
I think it's such a brilliant question to tackle. What will the world look like in 2040, in 2050, during the work span of a doctor qualifying now? I think that's such a brilliant question, because our minds are built on what I would call a brickwork mentality. You know, we're able to sort of take one step at a time and perhaps put one more brick in the wall, as being said. But to be able to think of a completely new world, an environment that we can't actually imagine, which may come upon us very quickly, that is a real challenge. I have often said that the writers of programs like Star Trek deserve real admiration because they projected themselves into worlds which were so far removed from the ordinary worlds that we live in. They had to invent complete new scenarios. So it's a good question. What kind of health and medical scenario might exist in 20 or 30 years' time? Well, we can have a stab at it. Firstly, I think that the relationship between doctors, patients and the public will be different. It's different already now from what it was, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. I think that the age of the apostolic doctor and the attitudes and feelings, which were perhaps much more patronizing in a few years ago, are no longer considered acceptable. And I think that the role of the patient and the public has changed from one of someone being a medicant to someone who is much more of a consumer. Equally, I think as far as public approaches are concerned, the changes are reflected in the desire to have much quicker action with a more accurate diagnosis. And I think inaccurate diagnoses or delayed diagnoses are not easily forgiven now. So if you put yourself into the year 2040, you can envisage a scenario where things are more rapid, the relationship is much more equal, and where I think accuracy is going to be the name of the game. The fact that we have mobile phones and access to information as easily as we have now means that artificial intelligence, machine learning, algorithms, and of course the whole field of genomics and personalized medicine is going to be absolutely key. And I think the differences will be huge between 2020 and 2040. And I think that we, each of us, may carry a blueprint of ourselves, which will determine the way we are diagnosed, treated, and managed. But to project yourself into that kind of scenario does require a darkened room, a good bottle of wine, and some very good company.
That sounds like the kind of workshop I could get stuck into. It struck me as nothing short of miraculous. I think it was about 18 months ago when the new generation of Apple Watch came out, and they'd managed to put a clinical grade ECG machine into the Apple Watch, effectively. If I'm casting my mind forward, as you say, almost in a mode of science fiction to 2040, you've described a conversation of equals, a conversation where there's a high expectation of accuracy and an understanding of an individual's response to either an illness or a set of circumstances. How do you think that conversation takes place? What kind of things do people talk about in that?
I think it's very perceptive to be asking ourselves, what then is the role of perhaps the human factor? In other words, the conversation between the clinician and the patient. Well, you might argue, of course, that there may be no need for doctors by then in the way that we have them now.
People have been trying that for a long time, and I'm not convinced that that's the right answer.
Yeah, but there could be many different modalities of delivering medical care, different practitioners with different skills, not least, of course, technologists. Interpretation is going to be a key asset. But perhaps the most important thing I want to say as part of this conversation is that we've been meeting over this topic now for the last 4 or 5 years. And one thing is clear, that the human element is going to become increasingly important. In the presence of high-level technologies, machine-learned algorithms and machine logic and so on, in the presence even of all those items, and even in the presence of highly developed personalized precision medicine, perhaps based on genomics, it will be the contact between some kind of care deliverer and the care receiver that will still remain very important. It seems somehow built into our DNA, if you'll forgive the expression, that discussing things with someone else and reaching a decision and making decisions for yourself is something that requires a human being. So I want to stress the fact that even our technology discussion group, as part of our project, which was working on emerging technologies and how they might affect us in 20 years' time, came to the conclusion that the human face of medicine will trump the presence of and the use of technologies. I think that's so important.
And the technology can, of course, be in the background doing all sorts of wonderful things. I mean, I guess ultimately it's about that. Traditionally, we would call like the family doctor, or in the UK, the GP, that first point of contact, unless you've really had something bad happen and you end up in hospital in an accident, emergency or whatever. Bringing that high technology, that personalized medicine, those different interventions into a sort of neighborhood family context, I think is really interesting. I was just picturing my GP surgery in Clapham, which is a sort of small brick bungalow on Clapham Manor Road, and thinking, how do we fit genomics and AI and all of these wonderful technologies into a small brick bungalow on the Clapham Manor Road? You know, what needs to happen with capabilities, with infrastructure, with training, with, you know, all sorts? You know, what do we need to do to create that revolution?
Well, that's another very good question, but I don't see it as much a challenge as some people might. Look at it like this. As new treatment came along, say, for duodenal ulcers, clinicians took on board those treatments and we started to use them. As new treatments came along for various infections, when antibiotics came into being, and now we have new treatments for raised blood pressure and all sorts of other things, they're part of our everyday clinical service. At the moment, it seems to me that genomics is seen as something a bit of an outsider, something that's practiced in buildings on the top of high mountains with scientists who have high-powered microscopes and very big computers. But the fact is that genomics is very rapidly becoming an everyday science, and it is something that needs to become part of the systemic parental structure of the practice of medicine. Look. We have patients already who come in and say, look, I've had my genome sequenced. Can you have a look at it for me, doctor, and see what I need to do about the future? So the real difficulty here is not so much lack of awareness either on the part of some of our patients or on the part of our clinicians. It's bridging that gap. There's confusion at the moment as to how to handle genomics in the primary care setting or in the brick building that might be your doctor's surgery. But it won't be long before we need to select patients for specific treatments. I mean, we already have this. Women unfortunate enough to develop breast cancer, their treatment is selected on the basis of the genomic structure of the tumor and their own genomic structure. So, five different women with different types of cancer might receive five different types of treatment. Equally, I think the time is coming along when management of people with what we regard as relatively common problems, such as hypertension, will be dependent on sort of genomic analysis and outcomes. But much more importantly, then, the earlier diagnosis of unusual problems and of cancers will be very much, I think, dependent on genomics. Already we have advances, for example, in the earlier detection of prostate cancer, whereby fragments of abnormal RNA, which are detected in the bloodstream, can be used as a means of finding the cancer, but also determining what kind of exact cancer cells are involved and what sort of treatment might be most effective. So I think that these developments will be taken up by primary care, which is the first port of call for most patients who come into the health service. But more than that, I think clinicians in general practice will be eager to take up these developments. We're keen on things that make things better for our patients and which improve the whole science of medicine. But I don't see a problem. The problem that does exist is that gap that I was talking about. How to make more people aware of what's available, what's practical, when can you use it, and how best to utilize it. I certainly see the role of Genomics England. One of the roles of Genomics England is to help produce this improvement in to reduce the gap between the high technology and its application at ground level.
bring it down from the mountain, so to speak.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think that actually the mountains are probably where the patients first consult. And it's not till you get way downstream that the person in the white coat and the microscope is working. So perhaps the analogy needs to be turned on its head if it's going to be effective.
The deep valley.
Yes.
Well, you're helping us fulfill our mission by explaining these things today. So thank you. You've just painted a picture of a world for us where we have these new types of insights, we're deploying these new types of technologies, and actually a lot of the work to do is around understanding, around deployment, around engagement. Let's think for a second about the doctors themselves. If we want to reach the sort of positive world of 2040, let's say, what changes do we need to make to the education of doctors, but also maybe even more importantly, to their continuing development as of the doctors that are already treating us today?
I think insofar as genomics is concerned, there needs to be a highly concentrated and concerted effort to make the whole world of genomics more accessible to the generalist, not just the general practitioner, but clinicians throughout the hospital settings, so they can understand the role of genomics and how it might assist them in their clinical functioning. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, a cardiologist should not be as au fait with the genomics of cardiac disease. I'm sure they are already, but in terms of the new technologies and what might be offered, as much as the GP who is looking for an earlier diagnosis for a problem that's hitherto been difficult to diagnose. So I think the real need is for translating this important technological field into a practical, pragmatic field. And here I have a bit of a difficulty. It's not quite a criticism, it's an observation. I think the field has remained somewhat too rarefied, and we were talking about mountaintops a little while ago. I think the next translational phase is going to be extremely important. Otherwise, it will somehow get submerged beneath the surface and remain so for a very much longer time than one would want.
In fact, the first guest we had on this podcast at the beginning of the year was Dr. Eric Topol of Topol Review fame, who was arguing, among other things, that every medical student these days should, on day one of their medical degree, extract their own DNA, sequence their own genome, and then use that to play with over the coming years of their education. I guess he was maybe being somewhat flippant, but I mean, do you think that you could extend that by analogy to every practicing doctor in the country today? What kind of steps, I guess, from the conventional to the radical, could we take to ensure that genomics doesn't sink under the surface of, you know, over specialism and bring it much more radically into the mainstream?
I think it's essential that genomics should move from being an ultra-specialist entity to being much more part of a generalism. Perhaps the push hasn't come as strongly as it should have from clinicians who themselves need to be looking for clues and for ways of treating the problems that they see in a more effective, timely manner. I sense that there is now a greater appetite for bringing the high technology side and the front-facing clinical side together. But I think that there will need to be investment. I don't mean merely in financial terms, although that's a separate issue, but certainly in terms of time and effort, certainly in training. As to how medical students should be taught, well, I mean, you might argue that perhaps the most important part of their training ought to concentrate on the human interaction side of things, because that is the heart of all transactions between human beings, and genomics is simply part of that. You know, all of medicine is not about genomics, it's a lot more than that. And I think that another area where the aspiring medical student whatever person becomes in charge of the genomic side of things in the future, we're making an assumption that genomics should sit at the heart of doctors' duties. I agree with that. But it might be much more efficient in the years to come for there to be genomic experts, you know, we could call them genomicists or something like that, whose role it is to sit within the red brick building that you described as your doctor's surgery to simply be concentrating on that bit of a person's health.
Maybe a related question is around genetic counselling. You mentioned earlier the scenario of someone coming into their GP surgery and saying, I've had my genome sequenced. Either I've done a sort of consumer genetics test, or I've managed to get a whole genome sequence from somewhere. Help me understand, doctor, what I should do about this. There are a lot of discussions in the kind of clinical genetics and genetics counseling professions around there aren't enough genetic counselors. Is a radical approach to this problem to say every GP should become a genetics counselor? How do we think about the interface between those professions?
I think a number of points come to mind when thinking about genetic counseling. Firstly, I think at the moment, there are certainly some specific areas, say with rare diseases or certain types of early cancer detection, where a person can be given quite specific advice about what needs to be done or what direction needs to be taken. But for many other areas, the link between a person's sort of chromosomes and their life outcomes is actually much more tenuous. I don't think that the science has reached a stage where very specific advice can be given in the majority of areas where genome sequencing has identified potential problems. So I think this is a field that needs to develop further. To a large extent, clinicians will pick up genomics and they'll, as you've indicated, retrofit the knowledge or learn it in a new way from medical school onwards. But there will, of course, need to be a role for specialist genetic counselors, not least in the area of reproductive medicine, where I think choices and awareness will become much more important in the future than now. The area that interests me a great deal, Chris, is the field of pharmacogenomics. How, for example, can we select a medication, a drug for a person based on their own genomic structure and how the illness or the problem that they have can be managed most effectively with a particular medication which may be suited to their genomic structure? I think that's going to require huge resources in terms of genomic mapping, identifying individuals who might benefit from either one management approach or another. And I think that I'm not sure that we are thinking as carefully as we ought to in terms of the future in this very important, crucial field of highly personalized medicine. A further thing that bothers me in that area is that some individuals may be suited to highly developed and tailored medications, and developing those particular products for those individuals may prove to be an extremely laborious and costly exercise. And whether society can afford to go down that route is a very important question.
And how would we incorporate pharmacogenomics into primary care? Is it as conceptually simple? I'm sure there are lots of systems complexities here, but as conceptually simple as saying, for this drug, like warfarin or whatever it is, we know that there are some people who have an adverse effect to it and some people who don't, and so we can do a genetic test to establish that. Or would you almost sort of turn that around 180 degrees and say, actually, for each person, we should be able to map what treatments they'll respond well to or poorly to? Or how would we bring that into the mainstream?
I think putting pharmacogenomics into mainstream general practice is going to be a challenge. In some ways, it's relatively straightforward. You might assume that certain decisions can be made on, say, the ethnicity or previous history of the individual. Choosing a drug for blood pressure management is an example there. But there is the other side of the coin, which is much more exciting, but also much more expensive and resource hungry, which is to identify a problem in someone and then to see if something can be tailored medication-wise, which will just suit them very specifically as a person. So it's like being measured for a suit. You know, we all have different shaped chests and arms and so on. And if you go to a bespoke tailor, can you have something made precisely for yourself? Or can you actually buy something off the shelf which can be just slightly altered to suit you? That's perhaps the kind of analogy which might be used for pharmacogenomics in the future.
So just to pick up on this point you were making about actually developing personalized treatments for individual people, there are a couple of outfits at the moment. I just met a startup recently that is using fruit flies to personalize the development of cancer treatments. And there are others looking at using organoids, like human organoids, sort of human tissue, to develop specific treatments to that specific person. Is that something that you would bring into our slightly sci-fi-ish kind of vision of 2040, 2050? Can you see that coming more towards the mainstream?
Yes, very much so. I think that we do need models in every instance when we're either developing new medications, interventions, I should call them. And I think a lot of the work has to start at a very small molecular level. And to link that with the human genome from the very start is extremely difficult. So I can see the use of these other models being developed a great deal over the years.
We go from a world in which we use lab mice as a model for human illness to actually using synthetic human tissue, which presumably is a much better model for another human being.
Yes, indeed. But just on the lighter side, someone mentioned to me the other day that we as humans share half our genes with a banana. I've never heard of anyone experimenting with a banana.
Absolutely. Or the point that we as humans have 20,000 genes and a grain of rice has 40,000 genes. So it's definitely not all just about the number of genes or which ones we share. In this world, we've talked about things like stratifying patients on the basis of risk, using genomics to do that, tailoring interventions or therapeutics to individual humans, using someone's genomic makeup as part of an understanding of their whole picture to kind of personalize the way that they think about health and wellness and medication. That's a lot to take in for doctors, and we've talked about some of the sort of continuing professional development and education and so on. If I'm the proverbial man or woman on the Clapham omnibus, how can we as a community, let's say, as a genomics community, think about best engaging and kind of listening to and bringing these people on the journey to that bright future vision?
I think it's so important to involve the public as well as clinicians in this very fast field of genomics as it develops at the speed at which it's going. And I think that one of the most important things we can do as part of our genomics initiative is to make the general public more aware of what's possible, not to lay out impossible scenarios of, you know, spaceships flying, you know, from London to Newcastle in 5 seconds or something like that, but to create a scenario whereby people have a more realistic understanding of what's possible. Perhaps you might argue that some of the PR that's gone on from the sort of genomics industry has over-egged things. Individuals are already demanding of their genome much more than is possible to deliver. You know, hence people turning up in the doctor's practice saying, here's my genome, please tell me, you know, how I can make sure I don't get any of these 19 diseases which might be, you know, which I might be susceptible to. So I think a very careful communications program has to be at the heart of any new science that is developing. And if it's going to develop effectively and also suffuse its way into the clinical arena, then I think, you know, a very good outreach program is crucial. Clinicians need to be brought in with programs which illustrate the clinical importance of genomics. You know, people working in various fields, in cancer, naturally, they are the closest to this, but also in other areas like gastroenterology, pediatrics, obstetrics, etc., and generalists, they need to get examples and illustrations of how genomics fits in. I think any meeting, for example, say for argument's sake, in gastroenterology ought to have a genomics element to it. And I think that, you know, any educational programs in any other field, you know, say rheumatology should have an important section on genomics built into it. It's how we create that culture of this new science suffusing into these other areas. That's what really matters. If it's seen as a science separate from everything else, it will remain on the outside.
And there's a fantastic series on Netflix at the moment called Diagnosis, where Dr. Lisa Sanders looks at various rare conditions and explores angles like genomics and other other techniques to do this. I think we need about 20 hit TV series to kind of get this on the public radar. So if I bring us right back into just the end of March 2021 when we're speaking, the NHS bill is about to be discussed and debated over the coming months. We have the Ben Goldacre report on healthcare data and its uses. There's lots of discussion at the moment about how we make changes in the aftermath, hopefully the aftermath, I don't know if we can quite describe this as the aftermath yet, of the pandemic. If you had a magic wand, what kind of one, two or three policy changes or decisions would you institute?
Firstly, I would ensure that we in the National Health Service had a visionary setup looking into the future. So it wouldn't be another brick in the wall, another step towards a goal, but sort of a vision of where we might be in order to motivate people and also to create the agenda for what it is that we need to learn and perhaps what we need to spend on. Secondly, as far as genomics is concerned, I would make a major push for it to be inculcated into all the clinical areas that we work in. Say mental health. I work with a big mental health trust as a non-executive director. I'm aware of the huge number of people who have serious mental illness and other mental health problems. And I'm depressed by the lack of genomic advance in those areas. There are many advances, I'm not denying them. An area which has been, I think, much less studied than, say, cancer or heart disease. So I would want to see genomics, to use that word, suffuse into different clinical areas so that it's parental and part of health rather than a world outside. The third thing is that I think with the fast-developing science area that we have, the high-level technologies that we're developing, especially with fast computers and the ability to make multiple computations, I think the world of highly personalized, genomically driven therapies is a world I would very much like to live in. And if I could make a personal comment there, as someone of South Asian background, I'm aware of the high level of conditions such as diabetes and impaired glucose tolerance that exist amongst people from the Southern Asian continent, also in the Middle East and elsewhere. And I think that, unlocking the specific areas which cause problems there, and perhaps in addition to public health measures, dealing, very specifically with targeted therapies would go an enormous distance towards improving matters.
That's brilliant. Pali, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. Really fantastic insights from, the front line, as you put it, of healthcare, and a great challenge to get genomics down from the mountaintop and into the omnibus if we keep switching metaphors. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure to do this podcast. I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G-Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G-Word.